his reputation would be damaged. He had been told that his son would live no more than 2 years. In fact, Neil lived 2 decades. The view that a child with a disability was an unmitigated tragedy reached an apotheosis in Simon Olshansky's oft-quoted description of parents' chronic sorrow. His was not the only such voice. The psychoanalysts Albert Solnit and Mary Stark lobbied in 1961 for a new DS mother to have physical rest, an opportunity to review her thoughts and feelings about the wished-for child, a realistic interpretation and investment of the feared, unwanted child by doctors and nurses, and an active role in planning for and caring for the newborn child as she is able. These are the measures through which the mother can minimize or overcome the trauma of giving birth to a retarded child. In 1966, the playwright Arthur Miller and his wife, the photographer Inga Morath, institutionalized their child with DS and told almost no one of his existence. In 1968, the ethicist Joseph Fletcher wrote in the Atlantic Monthly that there was no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome baby away. Whether it's put away in the sense of hidden in a sanatorium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person. Willowbrook, that hell house of the 1960s and early 1970s, happened for a reason. Parents who had been persuaded that their retarded children were not persons left them in repugnant conditions. Yet even as prejudice against those with intellectual disabilities was escalating, a new movement to help the disabled was also unfolding. The argument that the disabled warranted benevolent treatment coincided with a larger post-Enlightenment shift in our conceptions of early education. Historically, this had been the province of mothers, and the notion that experts had something to add began only with the founding of the first kindergartens in early 19th century Germany. At the end of the 19th century, Maria Montessori applied lessons she had learned from her work among the intellectually disadvantaged in Rome to typical children. Soon nursery schools began to crop up in Europe. In the United States, they burgeoned when the New Deal subsidized teaching jobs, then spread further as the Second World War effort called mothers into the workforce. At the same time, attempts to curtail childhood mortality were also underway, directed especially at the poor. The new science of behaviorism rose up in opposition to eugenics and suggested that people are made, not born, and can be educated and shaped into anything. The emerging field of psychoanalysis was concurrently examining how early trauma could interfere with healthy development, and some of its adherents began to question whether the shortcomings of the poor and disabled might be the result of early deprivation rather than organic inadequacy. The 1935 Social Security Act included a provision that the federal government would match state funds for treating the disabled. Investigators soon began to look at how a stimulating and enriching environment allowed poor children to transcend their apparent deficits. John Bowlby, the father of attachment theory, demonstrated that good maternal care was crucial to the development of the healthy child, an insight so obvious today that it is hard to remember how radical it was a mere 60 years ago. Eugenics was finally discredited when it devolved into the Holocaust. Meanwhile, the influx of handicapped veterans at the end of World War II softened social prejudice against disabled people in general. In 1946, the U.S. Office of Education set up a section for exceptional children, which led to better educational programs for people with special needs. But those children remained segregated from the larger society. In 1949, Anne Greenberg, the mother of a child with Down syndrome, placed advertisements in the New York Post, seeking other parents who shared her concerns. A year later, they founded the Association for Retarded Citizens, now known as the ARC, and still one of the most prominent organizations in the field. Most parents thought of DS entirely in terms of nature. The child has a genetic anomaly, and nothing can be done about it. Greenberg was among the parent activists on the side of nurture. The child has a genetic anomaly, and there is work to be done. When John F. Kennedy became president, he established a commission to study mental retardation and its possible prevention. Reintegration of the disabled into the larger society was spearheaded in part by his sister, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, whose 1962 article in the Saturday Evening Post about their sister Rosemary emphasized that even families of prominence and intelligence can have retarded children. She observed with sadness the poor living conditions to which most people with mental retardation were consigned. Her vision of change took meaningful form in the wake of the civil rights movement's rethinking of social inequalities. Black people had for so long been described as constitutionally inferior, and when they rose up against that characterization, they opened the door for other marginalized people to do the same. Head Start, founded in 1965, was dedicated to the idea that people lived in poverty not because inherent deficits qualified them for nothing better, but because they had not received appropriate and constructive early stimulus. Head Start combined health, education, and social services and trained parents as active partners in the treatment of their children. By the end of the 1960s, insights from Head Start were being applied to people with intellectual disabilities, and in particular to children with Down syndrome. It became clear that people with DS showed a wide range of functioning, and that it was absurd to predict a newborn's abilities simply from his diagnosis. It seemed to follow that writing such people off at birth was unfair, and that their capacities should be maximized, both to give them a better life and to avoid later costs. Early intervention was better value for money than remediation. In 1973, Congress passed, over President Nixon's veto, the Rehabilitation Act, which stated, "No otherwise qualified handicapped individual in the United States shall, solely by reason of his handicap, be excluded from the participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under, any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." Even with the budget cuts of the Reagan years, programs for disabled children remained in force. This population had become entrenched and drew broad public sympathy. The cause reached a triumphal apogee with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, which extended the 1973 protections beyond the confines of federally funded programs. Parents, with support from disabled people themselves, had capitalized on changing ideas about humanity. They had validated lives long considered worthless. If racial minorities and the poor deserved support and respect, then so did people with Down syndrome and related conditions. If help to these other groups was best given early, then so, too, was aid to people with intellectual disabilities. Early intervention, EI, is now a federal program for infants with any of a broad range of complaints. Low birth weight, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, autism, and it has vastly raised levels of functioning in all these groups. EI services provided before a child turns 3 may include physical therapy, occupational therapy, nutrition counseling, audiology and vision services, nursing support, speech-language therapy, and instruction on assistive technology, as well as support and training for parents who have trouble coping. It entails a strong focus on sensory stimulation of all kinds. Hospitals are required to tell parents about these services. EI is available to people at every socioeconomic level, sometimes through home visits, and sometimes in special centers. These early services are also a form of parent training and may help families to feel optimistic about keeping their children at home. The quality of services for children with particular disabilities varies enormously from state to state. New York, for example, has especially good EI services for DS, and anecdotes tell of people moving to the state specifically to access them. EI is the full expression of the nurture over nature argument, the ultimate triumph of psychoanalysis, civil rights, and empathy over eugenics, sterilization, and segregation. It grew out of a strange nexus of federal politics, parent activism, and psychology. It was a result of changing understandings of non-disabled children and new theories of general early education. It continues to evolve today as many forms of engagement are grouped under that now ubiquitous rubric. Change in both treatment and acceptance of people with DS, however, continues to be driven by parents. By demanding that physicians treat their children's physical ailments as respectfully as they would those of non-disabled children, they have brought about an astonishing increase in life expectancy for people so diagnosed. If early intervention is ultimately a vague and ever-evolving umbrella term for a broad range of protocols, it has nonetheless been the organizing phrase for a radical rethinking of the lives of disabled people. Where science and biological cure have been stalled, the social model of disability has achieved wild triumph. Many specific techniques are invaluable in addressing particular needs, but the long and short of it is that disabled children, like non-disabled children, thrive on attention, engagement, stimulation, and hope. When Elaine Gregory's daughter, Lynn, was born in 1970, a few years before Jason Kingsley, the obstetrician announced to the baby's father, "Your daughter is a mongoloid idiot." Elaine, just 23 years old, already had a son, Joe, 2.5, and she decided not to have more children. She had never heard of EI. Lynn was a baby a very long time, Elaine said. She didn't sit up till she was 12 months old. She didn't walk till she was almost 2. Elaine went to an agency, YAI, where a doctor gave her some little exercises to do with Lynn. When Elaine returned 2 years later, the agency asked her whether she'd like to work there part-time, because they had a severely handicapped little girl with seizures, and they wanted a nurse around. So Lynn was in the first preschool program that Brooklyn ever had, for 2 hours, twice a week. "And I was right there to learn what I could," Elaine said. She became increasingly interested in the brand new field of early intervention, and Lynn's school asked her to run their program. Like Jason Kingsley, Lynn was immensely nourished by the nascent EI movement. She competed in the Special Olympics as a gymnast and an ice skater. Her motor skills were always better than her cognitive skills, so Elaine mainstreamed her in recreational programs, but not in educational ones. She was in a regular Girl Scout troop, and in a swimming program with typical kids. But she was always with the younger kids, Elaine said. She was 10, and she was with 6-year-olds. You keep her where she can succeed. Sometimes, Elaine recalled, she needed to be reminded that her son needed equal praise for his accomplishments. Lynn didn't walk until she was almost 2, but she was so small that she looked much younger. Everybody would come to our house and go, "She's walking," Elaine recalled. My son came up to me one day and said, "Mom, look." He walked back and forth in front of me. He said, "I know how to walk too." After that, I told people, "When you come into my house, you look at and you praise both my children." Despite the attention Lynn's condition demanded, Joe's relationship to his sister was generally positive. Elaine remembers the story of a schoolmate who said to Joe that his sister was retarded. It was hurled as an insult, but Joe didn't notice that. He just said, "Yes, she is," and got into a conversation about what it meant. "I'd wanted Joe to know that word, so it wouldn't be a shock to him," Elaine said. It really was an eye-opener that he realized that. It was like saying she had brown hair and brown eyes. Many years later, when Joe and his wife were expecting each of their sons, their obstetrician suggested that they go to a geneticist. Joe agreed, but said each time that he wanted to have the baby even if he had Down syndrome. "I was surprised at that," Elaine said. "That was when I knew that Joe really didn't feel she was a negative." As an adult, Lynn works in a cafeteria, earning minimum wage, and she lives in a community residence. When I met the Gregalys, she had been there about 10 years. Lynn reads on a first grade level. She can do basic math with a calculator. Elaine said that she often wonders how much higher Lynn's functioning might be if she had had early intervention as it is now practiced. When I met Elaine, she and Lynn were fresh from a trip to Disney World with Joe and his wife and 2 young children. Lynn was the aunt, Elaine said. She took them on every ride, she bought them shirts, she really did great. Her nephews just love her. They play with her, she plays with them, she really enjoys them. "I would love for Lynn to be a teacher or a doctor, and she's a cafeteria worker. But for her, it's perfect. She loves that paycheck, and she goes to the bank and cashes it and puts it in her checking account, writes her own checks. That's a big thing for her, so I've learned to love it too." Until her retirement in 2008, Elaine Gregaly served as assistant director of YAI, National Institute for People with Disabilities, the same agency she visited when Lynn was 2. At YAI, part of Elaine's job was to tell other parents about EI. "All parents want to help their kids," she said, "even if they're distracted by poverty or drug addiction. Since early intervention is free, they go for it, and they mostly end up repeating things with their kids after the social worker leaves. The organization offers psychological counseling and respite care for families of people with disabilities. It serves 20,000 people a day." Elaine also counseled parents who had a prenatal diagnosis of DS. "They're 4 months pregnant and have to make a decision within a week or two about whether to abort," she said. "I'll tell them all the good things and some difficulties. The parents may never accept what happened to them and yet accept their child. They're 2 separate things. The parental loss, and the actual person they will almost always end up loving." The 2 key movements in educating disabled children after they've graduated from EI are mainstreaming and inclusion. Unlike EI, these 2 approaches affect non-disabled children. In the 1970s and 1980s, parents advocated for mainstreaming so that disabled students could be taught mostly in dedicated classrooms within ordinary public schools. The 1990s brought a shift to inclusion, which educates disabled children in the same classrooms as their non-disabled peers, often with a special assistant. The most recent major piece of legislation in this area is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 1990. IDEA, which requires that all children with disabilities receive a free, appropriate public education in the least restrictive possible environment. This integrating of disabled children into regular schools has changed the appearance of the American classroom. Children with intellectual disabilities are usually educated in some mix between special ed and heterogeneous classrooms, unless their disabilities are too extreme for that to be viable. They may go to special schools only after every attempt has been made at achieving the least restrictive environment. There are two essential questions in the debate about these philosophies. What is better for the child with a diagnosis, and what is better for the typical children, those without such a diagnosis? Some parents complain that disabled children in the classroom are a distraction and slow down learning for the rest. Conversely, Michael Berube, co-director of the Disability Studies Program at Penn State, whose son has DS, argues that inclusion's benefits are truly universal, because being in a classroom with other people with disabilities breaches the widespread distrust of and discomfort with people who are unwell, and makes those who are able-bodied more humane. Children with DS who are included have good role models for language development, learn behavioral norms, and tend to realize more of their potential than they would in an environment predicated on their limitations. Integrated education prepares people with DS for supervised employment, freeing them from the sheltered workshops of times past. It helps more of them to live relatively independently. Public schools are often required to be inclusive. Fights still occur to incorporate these policies in private schools. The pitfall is that people with DS who are in inclusion programs are often cut off from their peers, and people without DS are willing to go only a certain distance in building relationships with people who have the condition. If the school superintendent and the principal and the teachers all buy into it and educate themselves, I think inclusion works beautifully, said Arden Moulton, one of the founders of the National Down Syndrome Society, NDSS. But it also depends on the child. Some children shouldn't be in inclusion programs, just like some kids shouldn't be at Yale. Betsy Goodwin, NDSS's co-founder, said, "The purists end up with lonely kids. Teen years are hard enough. You can't expect a normal teen to have his best friend have a disability. It just isn't the way it works." Betsy Goodwin was young and fit and didn't expect complications when her daughter Carson was born with Down syndrome in 1978 in New York. At the time, patients in private practice were generally counseled to institutionalize, and patients in clinics were instructed to take the baby home. In Betsy's view, this is because doctors who had personal relationships with their patients were ashamed of what they saw as their failure. Her obstetrician said, "Why don't you have a healthy baby, and we'll forget about this one?" Barton Goodwin had been open to the possibility of leaving Carson behind. He feared that he would lose Betsy to the world of disability. Betsy was also frightened, but more frightened of the alternative. She called her childhood friend Arden Moulton, a social worker, and said that the doctors wanted her to institutionalize her child. Arden said that was the last thing Betsy should do. However, the lack of resources for DS babies and their families quickly became clear. A few months later, Betsy, until then an interior decorator, decided to start an organization for parents in her situation and asked Arden to help her. "I was a professional," Arden recalled, "and she had the perspective of a parent." That is how, in 1979, the National Down Syndrome Society was established. The first project of the NDSS was to organize a conference for scientists working on any aspect of Trisomy 21, as there had never before been such a gathering, and the work was diffuse. At that time, total research in the United States on DS was about $2 million annually. It is now approaching $12 million, which is still low for a condition that affects so many people. Betsy went to Washington to meet with the head of the NIH, who told her that with amniocentesis, there would soon not be anyone born with Down syndrome. "I don't know whether he'd met anyone Catholic," she said dryly 25 years later. Betsy became pregnant again when Carson was 2, and she considered amniocentesis. She wasn't sure whether she'd have had an abortion if she'd known that Carson would be born with DS. "I wasn't sure why I was doing it," she said. "To terminate? I honestly can't say. I wanted, at least, to know. But for some reason, he kept getting in the way of the needle, so we never obtained a good read. The amnio goes into 22 weeks, and a baby can survive at 24, so it was becoming very unpleasant for me. I finally said to Barton, 'You can divorce me tomorrow, but I'm not going to go on with this process. I'm going to have what I have.' Betsy's son was born typical, as was another son a few years later." "My 3 kids get along great," Betsy said. "That was another warning of the obstetrician. It's going to ruin your marriage, and any kids you have subsequently will suffer. I really think, almost to a one, the siblings of kids with Downs grow up to be more sensitive and thoughtful, maybe even more fulfilled, than the rest of the population." The Goodwins loved New York City, but when Carson turned 11, Betsy thought New York was not the place to foster independence in someone who couldn't form adult judgments. "So I came up with Greenwich, Connecticut, which has a policeman on every corner. It struck me as a very safe town for a young woman like her to be walking around." Carson has a warm personality and is socially comfortable. When her brothers were in high school, she loved to dance. "I used to see this arm come out of her bedroom, and she'd grab one of her brother's friends and make them dance with her," Betsy said. "Some of them, to this day, as men say, 'I never would have known that step if it weren't for Carson.'" When I met Carson, she had recently lost her job at a Whole Foods because she always seemed to put the tomatoes on the bottom of the bag. "She's never been a tomato fan," Betsy said. "I assure you that the donuts would be on top." Carson has trouble understanding that other people think or feel differently. Her mother's preference for John Coltrane over Britney Spears, for example, baffles her. She knows that her Down syndrome makes her different, even though she doesn't grasp exactly how. "That is why," Betsy explained, "her dancing gives her so much joy. She loves anything that makes her an equal." In the last 3 decades, NDSS has grown up alongside the child who inspired it. Since Carson was born, it has awarded millions of dollars in scientific grants and has also supported social scientists focused on better educational strategies for people with intellectual disabilities. Once a year, NDSS organizes a conference at which scientists present their work to parents. The society has set up an annual buddy walk, which takes place in 200 locations around the United States. People with Down syndrome walk with a friend to raise money and awareness. Buddy walk events now bring in about $500,000 a year to the organization. They also build community for people with DS and their families. The National Down Syndrome Society has had to steer its way through treacherous waters. Some parents are concerned that an organization that researches ways to cure or ameliorate the symptoms of DS is not providing the affirmation that people with the syndrome need. Anti-abortion disability activists have long argued that selective termination devalues the lives of disabled people. Some have tried to persuade the NDSS leadership to take a strong position against abortion. NDSS would like to see more people keeping children with DS. but not because they are forced to do so by law. Until Ronald Reagan signed the Baby Doe Amendment in 1984, which classed the neglect or withholding of treatment for disabled infants as child abuse, parents and physicians could essentially let such infants die if they wished. The Princeton ethicist Peter Singer has espoused the right of women to choose abortion through the end of pregnancy and to commit infanticide on newborns if they so choose. He has defended this position with the utilitarian argument that most women who eliminate an unwanted child will produce a wanted one, and that the loss of happiness of the child who is killed, whose life would have been unsatisfactory, is outweighed by the happiness of the healthy child who follows. Although Singer's position is extreme, it reflects the pervasive devaluation of people with Down syndrome and the assumption that their lives are displeasing to others and to themselves. One mother described being asked by a psychiatrist how she got on with her son with Down syndrome. When she replied, "Terrific," he said there was no need to be defensive. Marka Bristow, who chairs the National Council on Disability, said, "Singer's core vision amounts to a defense of genocide." By 2000, the resistance to prenatal screening from the disability rights camp had crystallized. Disability scholars Adrian Ash and Eric Parenz, in their seminal discussion of the problem, wrote, "Prenatal diagnosis reinforces the medical model that disability itself, not societal discrimination against people with disabilities, is the problem to be solved. Prenatal genetic testing followed by selective abortion is morally problematic, and it is driven by misinformation." A few years later, Ash wrote, "Researchers, professionals, and policymakers who uncritically endorse testing followed by abortion act from misinformation about disability and express views that worsen the situation for all people who live with disabilities now and in the future." Leon Cass, chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics under George W. Bush, has argued that we treat prenatally diagnosed illnesses by killing rather than tending to those who would develop them. Preventing births of any subclass of people devalues them. A society in which fetuses with Down syndrome are routinely aborted clearly believes that DS is a grave misfortune. This does not mean that anyone hates or wants to slaughter people with DS. Indeed, many people who would choose to terminate a DS pregnancy would also go out of their way to be kind to a living person with the syndrome. But I know from personal experience how kind sympathy can be a noxious prejudice. I do not care to spend time with people who pity me for being gay, even if their sympathy reflects a generous heart and is offered with egregious politesse. Ash claims that women abort disabled fetuses because of the woeful lives that would come of their pregnancies, that such woe is the product of chauvinism, that such chauvinism could be resolved. Janice McLaughlin, at the University of Newcastle, wrote, "Mourning the choice the woman is compelled to make is not the same as saying she is wrong or an active participant in discrimination. Instead, it points to the ways in which she, too, is a victim. But the acts of those women do not merely reflect the society. They create it. The more such pregnancies are terminated, the greater the chance that more will be terminated. Accommodations are contingent on population. Only the ubiquity of disability keeps the disability rights conversation alive at all. A dwindling population means dwindling accommodation." Of the 5,500 children born with DS in the United States each year, about 625 are born to women who had prenatal diagnosis and chose not to terminate. One doctor assured Tierney Temple Fairchild, who had a prenatal diagnosis, "Almost everything you want to happen will happen. It's just going to happen at a different schedule." This is untrue. A great deal does not happen on any schedule for people with DS. The remark was nonetheless helpful to the family in deciding to keep their child, and they didn't have amnio in subsequent pregnancies. I had a choice, and I chose life, Fairchild wrote. Does that make me pro-choice or pro-life? Our political parties tell us we can't have it both ways. I chose life, but I am thankful I had the choice. Like deafness and dwarfism, Down syndrome may be an identity, or a catastrophe, or both. It may be something to cherish, or something to eradicate. It may be rich and rewarding, both for those whom it affects directly, and for those who care for them. It may be a barren and exhausting enterprise. It may be a blend of all these. I've never seen a family who chose to have the baby and then were really sorry, Elaine Gregory said. There is a strong movement to connect expectant mothers with a prenatal Down's diagnosis with families bringing up children with DS. Many parents have written memoirs expressing the rewards of raising such children, contending that there is less to complain of in Down syndrome than in the attitudes of the world. Of course, people who dislike having children with DS don't tend to write memoirs. Neither do those of low socioeconomic status, for whom the obstacles to good treatment may be daunting. My own observation is that some parents manufacture an affirmative construction of their child's disability to disguise their despair, while others have a deep and genuine experience of joy in caring for disabled children, and that sometimes the first dance can generate the second. I met disability activists who insisted that everyone's joy was authentic, and I met psychologists who thought no one's experience was. The truth is that while some people fall at either end of the spectrum, most are scattered across its wide span. Deirdre Featherstone didn't want children, so she was delighted to learn that she was infertile. When she became pregnant in 1998, however, she felt she was stuck, and she decided to let things unfold. She was 38, but not inclined to seek amniocentesis. I believe certain things are not your business, she said. If that baby is supposed to be inside alone for 9 months, then you need to leave it alone. You don't go sticking things into their environment. Her husband, Wilson Madden, wanted to do amnio. I wanted to give him that, because he likes to plan, she said. But the night before I said, what if we found out something? He said, I don't think that would make any difference. I said, well, if I find out there's something wrong, this kid's out of here, because as you well know, I don't want to be anyone's mother. I don't even have the courage to be the parent of a regular kid. I'm perfectly ready to have an abortion if there's anything wrong. You aren't, so you'd better stop pushing the amnio. They didn't have the test. Thank God, because it would have been the biggest mistake of my life, Deirdre said. You can't assess what you don't know. The day before her daughter, Catherine, was born, Deirdre, who is a jeweler and stylist, was supposed to be accessorizing a fashion show. She worked that afternoon, reviewing the outfits, then went home and had Thai food. When she began to heave in the night, Wilson realized she was in labor. She insisted it was just the takeout. A midwife delivered Catherine at home at 10 the next morning and told her to see a pediatrician straight away. The pediatrician confirmed visually that Catherine had Down syndrome. I already knew that Catherine was the nicest person I was ever going to meet, Deirdre said. It was harder for Wilson. It's probably always harder for the father because they haven't had a physical relationship with the child for 9 months. The pediatrician sent them for genetic screening the next day to confirm the diagnosis. I had tears coming down my face, and she reaches up, Deirdre said. She has one tear coming out of her eye, and she wipes my face. 23 hours old. Catherine was born into a very different world from the pre-EI one Lynn Gregory and Carson Goodwin had entered, and Wilson felt that they had to look into every available mode of treatment. Deirdre said, "One of the things that made the early period difficult was that she would have therapy, 3 times a week for speech, then occupational therapy, then physical therapy, and also craniosacral therapy. Her schedule was so full, it was hard for me to leave the house." That was probably the only difficulty, besides adjusting to the fact that somebody else is depending on you to live. I said to Wilson, "If this is more than you can handle, you're free to go. I won't hold it against you, and I won't think you're a bad person. But you can't stay upset forever." Wilson explained, "It never occurred to me to leave, but I was slower to get into the whole thing than Deirdre." Deirdre surprised even herself. "I was so sure I was the parent who was not going to be able to deal with a child who was in any way different," she said. "I was just relieved to love her. She was very lovable. All my friends had these children they thought were perfect, and then they've had to come to terms with their children's limitations and problems. I had this baby everyone thought was a disaster, and my journey has been to find all the things that are amazing about her. I started off knowing she was flawed, and all the surprises since then have been good ones. She's one of the nicest, kindest, most thoughtful, sensitive people that I've ever met. She's funny. She always highlights the positive. I don't know how much of that is personality, or if that's Down syndrome. When she makes up her mind that she's not doing something, that is that, which is also typical of Down syndrome." The mother of a child with special needs inevitably becomes a soothsayer. "Somebody I know called me up in tears saying, 'I just found out my kid has DS. What should I do?' I said, 'What do you want to do?' She said, 'It's my baby, and I want to have it.' I said, 'I'll tell you what, it's the best thing that has ever happened to me. And had I had the information, I would have made this big, big mistake by not having her. You've met my kid. We have a really good time.'" Recounting this to me, Deirdre added, "Down syndrome is easy, or at least Catherine is easy. Autism is probably a different experience. Would I make her life easier? Any way I could. Would I blink and turn her normal? No, I wouldn't. She may at some point have a different opinion and want to get facial surgery or some other normalizing procedure, whatever's out there by the time she grows up. Would I endorse her doing so if that's what she chose? If it comes up, I will. But I hope that I'll have raised her with enough personal strength and self-esteem to be happy in who she is." Deirdre never had to make her way through the gauntlet of prejudice that so determined Emily Pearl Kingsley's early experiences. "People still give up their child. People still have abortions when they find out," Deirdre said. "I'm not here to judge it. You hate lima beans, I love lima beans. There's a lot of political correctness that I find ridiculous. But I'll take whatever's made it unacceptable to make fun of a child because she's different. I think we are less tolerant of prejudice than anywhere else or any other time." She described being at Catherine's public school in Tribeca one day when a 5-year-old girl said, "I heard that when Catherine was inside you, you broke your egg, and that's why she came out funny." Deirdre said, "If you break your egg, then you don't have a baby at all." The little girl said, "You mean she's not broken?" Deirdre said, "No, she's not broken. She's a little different." Deirdre looked around the play area and said, "See that little girl over there? She has red, curly hair, and you have blonde hair. This little boy, he's black, and his mom and dad are white, and they're Italian, and his sister is his sister, but they're not really related biologically." One of the parents nearby said, "I'm Korean, and my husband's white." Another said, I didn't marry a man, but my partner is a lady, so my child is also different. In this world of infinite variety, Catherine was just another variation on the idea that the only normality is non-normality. Sometimes I see somebody with a child with Downs, and I'll say, "My daughter's in the same situation, she's 8, Deirdre said. 9 times out of 10 people will say, "Congratulations, welcome to the club." I think a lot of us feel lucky. As a mother, Deirdre is astonishingly patient. I witnessed her negotiating Catherine down from resistance on more than one occasion, capably steering her way around direct confrontation. Catherine tends to want to wear inappropriate clothes. She sometimes insists on a sundress when it's cold out. I say, "Why don't you wear pants under your dress or over your dress?" Sometimes she looks like she has furnished herself from a homeless shelter. She's good with that, so what am I going to say? I'm supposed to be building self-esteem, not knocking it down. It has been harder to maintain a sense of humor about the inevitable battles with the system, however. Wilson said, "It's important that she not be the slowest kid in the room. Maybe 100% inclusion all the way is not the best. We're looking at a camp that caters to special needs kids." Deirdre has a tigress's instinct when it comes to her daughter's education. Her first kindergarten was not a fit at all. I requested a transfer on day 2. Her education is just so important. It's more important than breathing. I had been to the Board of Ed back and forth, and finally one day, I hired a babysitter for Catherine for a week, and I packed a bag with my computer, a power pack, electrical cords, my cell phone, chargers, several days' worth of clothes, books. I went to the Board of Ed and said, "I need to meet with the special needs coordinator for this Board of Ed." "I'm sorry, she's not in. Can you come back?" "No, I'm just going to stay. It's no trouble whatsoever. I have enough things for 7 days, and I will sit her until she has time, but I don't want to rush her in any way." I sat there taking different things out of my suitcase and making sure that everyone knows, "Oh, underwear. Underneath that's the charger, and I'll get it out now, then put the underwear back in." After 4.5 hours, somebody came out and said, "Can we help you?" Catherine was in a new school by the end of February. "I'm never unpleasant," Deirdre said, "but I make it clear that I do need certain needs met." 5 years later, I asked Deirdre how Catherine's education was going. I was asking her about vocabulary words for school, and she said her new words were opportunity and deficient. I asked her for the definition of deficient, and she thought about that and finally answered, "You, Mom." Deirdre burst out laughing. "I don't have a fear that everyone's going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing as a mother, because I've already admitted that. The question is how you educate yourself. Sometimes I think I'm a great mother. Sometimes I think I suck. I've never once in a million years said that I know what I'm doing being somebody's mother. I barely know what I'm doing being somebody's wife." People with DS develop slowly and stop short of typical intellectual maturity, but their development usually runs on a steady course. Anyone who can relate to a typical child through various developmental stages can relate to a person with DS. DS babies are slow to make eye contact, slow to sustain it, and slow with imitative behaviors. They do not start to speak until they are 2 or 3 years old, and they do not make 2- and 3-word phrases until they are 3 or 4 years old. DS children often fail to grasp fundamental principles of grammar. I once asked someone who worked with people with DS why some are so much smarter than others, and she said, "Why are some people without DS so much smarter than others?" Though the parallel holds, some people do have worse DS than others. David Patterson, a geneticist working on trisomy 21, recently wrote, "It is virtually certain that genes on chromosome 21 do not work alone to cause the features we recognize as Down syndrome. They must work in concert with genes on other chromosomes. This is likely to be one of the reasons for the wide diversity seen in persons with Down syndrome." People with Down syndrome are often warm and sociable, eager to please, and free of cynicism. Larger studies indicate that many people with Down syndrome are also stubborn, defiant, aggressive, and sometimes disturbed. In addition to the physical challenges that some people with DS face, many have behavioral issues, including ADHD and oppositional disorders. Those with milder cases tend toward depression and pronounced anxiety. The popular image is not so much groundless as incomplete. The experience of living with DS is not easy. According to a large recent study, these children generally have less idealized views of themselves and experience repeated exposures to failure, which contributes to uncertainty and learned helplessness, which in turn has been linked to depression and other problems. People with DS are relatively low energy and consistent in their behavior, which means that they are less demanding of caregivers than people with high energy, chaotic disorders such as bipolar disorder and autism. Both children and adults with DS are at heightened risk for physical and sexual abuse. Those with behavioral problems are more often placed out of the home by their families. They are less likely to fit in well in those settings either, however, because they wear out paid support staff and are harder to take out in public. All of this, of course, exacerbates the symptoms that underlie their behavior. Many treatments exist for the symptoms of DS, but none alleviates the condition itself. The extra chromosome cannot be suppressed or removed, though there is preliminary work on gene therapy to achieve this. Vitamin regimens have been in use to treat people with DS since the 1940s, as have off-label antihistamines and diuretics, though none of these has been shown to have any benefit. Some, indeed, have been shown to have minor adverse effects. In addition, plastic surgery protocols can normalize the appearance of people with DS. Such procedures include a sometimes pragmatic shortening of the tongue, which is said to reduce drooling, improve speech, and help people with DS to breathe better, and a wide range of cosmetic interventions, such as nose jobs, remove excess fat from the neck, and reshaping of the eyes to eliminate their slant. The National Down Syndrome Society and other groups object to these measures as unnecessarily painful and even cruel, the DS version of limb lengthening, and also take umbrage at the prejudice against people who look as if they have Downs. They would like to use public education to change responses to a DS face rather than change its appearance. Michelle Smith, a financial advisor at Wachovia Bank, is a perfectionist, and it is not easy for perfectionists to have children with disabilities. She has displaced her perfectionism onto mothering. If there is a perfect way to handle having a child with a disability, Michelle Smith has found it. She has even done a perfect job of renouncing perfection. About 15 weeks into her pregnancy, Michelle went for an alpha-fetal protein blood test. Her obstetrician said her results placed her at elevated risk for DS and offered her amnio. "I didn't even tell my husband that was an option," she recalled. "I went into complete and total denial. The person I'd always been would have been the super competitive New York mom, the right clothes, the right barber, the right job. I would see disabled people and be so freaked out that I would just not look. But weird things happened during my pregnancy. I turned the TV on and just randomly saw a Touched by an Angel episode with the guy with DS. I was in Home Depot, 8 months pregnant, and this Down syndrome little girl walked right up to me, with no mother or father with her, and put her hand on my stomach. I thought, obviously somebody's trusting me with this pregnancy. At the delivery of Michelle's son, Dylan, the midwife thought his neck was a little thick. She looked up Michelle's blood test. An hour later, she told Michelle that her son had Down syndrome. They put him on my stomach, and he gave me a spooky look, where I actually felt like he was the sage, and I was the child, Michelle said. I was intimidated by him, in this really beautiful way. Michelle was determined not to look at things darkly, but at first it was hard. The baby stirred up all her own fears and insecurities. When she brought Dylan home from the hospital, she entered her apartment building through the back door, because she was afraid of what the doorman might say. When she got in an elevator with Dylan, she would blurt out his diagnosis. "I felt everyone was staring," she said, "but it was just all about my judgments." As Michelle recounted it, her husband, Jeff, couldn't handle having a DS baby. "You have a conversation before you get married about children," she said. "Sometimes about money, sometimes about religion. You rarely discuss what you do with a pregnancy with a special needs kid." Jeff said that none of this would have happened if Michelle had just had the amnio. "Yes, it would have," Michelle said. "He would still be here." Jeff went through 8 months of depression, and by the time he began to emerge, she had decided she wanted a divorce. Immediately after the birth, Michelle began doing research on treatment for infants with DS. She read Welcome to Holland, which helped her. "I read 11 books in the first 2 weeks," she said. "Then I met some other moms who have been my saving grace. We have a group of four, and we call ourselves the Downs Moms, and they're all women that I would be friends with anyway. They taught her how to navigate EI and everything that followed." Michelle found an EI program located in the World Trade Center. 3 months after Dylan was born, 9/11 happened. That was the end of the center. As she tried to figure out what to do next, Michelle felt the fighter in her coming to the surface. "The service coordinator for your agency is walking that fine line between giving you what you deserve, legally, and saving the state money." One of the other mothers said, when I had a bad meeting, "Oh, you poor little neophyte. Here, pick yourself up." So I hired a special ed attorney to go to the second meeting with me. "I don't know what you do if you're poor or uneducated with a Down syndrome kid, and you don't even know what you don't know." Dylan soon proved to have problems that EI could not address. He had recurrent intestinal crises that landed him in the hospital repeatedly, 41 emergency room visits in his first 11 months. "I had a frequent flyer card in the ER," Michelle said. "I would call and admit myself." Dylan needed three major operations. Physicians at Columbia gave him a 2% chance of survival. Jeff and Michelle lived in the intensive care unit with him for 9 weeks straight. "He was on 14 machines," Michelle recalled. "They brought in a 15th machine, the dialysis machine. I sat there looking at him thinking, just go. It's okay. I can't do this either. I felt so guilty saying that. I couldn't handle watching my kid die. The priest comes in 4 times to read last rites. There were women on the second floor of that hospital who were so affected by my son, they came up daily and prayed over him with rosary beads." As Dylan fought for his life, the Down syndrome became secondary. By this time, Jeff also had overcome his negative early response. His conversion came too late for the marriage, but not too late for his son. "It wasn't until we almost lost him that Jeff realized how much he loved him," Michelle said. "Now they're inseparable. Jeff adores this child." Dylan emerged at a year old with 22 inches of his colon missing and a patched heart. But his physical health has been excellent since then. He has a little gas problem,